Hello. Today, we at Green Blue Urban are privileged to host two speakers from Mott MacDonald to talk to us today about biodiversity net gain. We're very glad to welcome Julia Baker, who's Head of Nature Services, and Tanith Cook, who is a Senior Associate at Mott Mac. And we can understand perhaps some of the challenges that we're facing in the construction industry with biodiversity net gain. And perhaps we'll get a bit of a clue as how we can incorporate it without it necessarily costing us huge amounts more or taking massive amounts of space, which seems to be some people's view on the whole Mott legislation. So perhaps we can start with you, Tanith. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. So what is biodiversity? And why is it important? Perhaps you can define it for me and give me a clue of where this whole idea came from.
Hi, Howard. Thanks for inviting us today. It's great to be here. So a textbook answer, biodiversity is the variety of life on Earth in all its forms, functions and interactions. It includes bacteria, plants, animals and humans. Everything we depend upon to live and survive, we rely upon biodiversity. From the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat. Therefore, it's incredibly important that we look for ways to maintain and overall increase biodiversity, both locally, nationally, and internationally. And that's why I think it's so important that we have biodiversity net gain becoming mandatory in November this year.
That's really interesting. So it really covers the whole scope of life on Earth, for which we are seeing that there has become quite a significant drop of that in many of our urban areas as humanity has really driven out other forms of life. And that's really interesting. But what does this idea of net gain mean, Julia? Perhaps you can give us some idea of why we're looking for net gain. Why aren't we just satisfied with what we've got?
Yes. Yeah, it is a really good question. So biodiversity net gain is actually quite simple. It's development that leaves biodiversity in a measurably better state than before. And simple in the way that I phrase that, development is a force for good. So because that development has happened, and that might be a road or a railway or a housing estate or whatever that development is, nature's better off. Now, there's a complicated way of getting there, but I want to really highlight that because that's the litmus test. And we'll come into metrics and the mandatory approach, but we need to keep sight of that ultimate benchmark. Has that development left biodiversity in a measurably better state than before? Now, you talked about mandatory biodiversity net gain, and Tanith, you mentioned it as well. So mandatory biodiversity net gain is coming into force this November for most development seeking planning permission. So it's going through the Town and Country Planning Act. And for most developments, so for small sites developments, that will come in April 2024. And for nationally significant infrastructure projects, it's expected late 2025. So as a condition of planning, developments will have to demonstrate that they can achieve a minimum 10% increase in their biodiversity value. Now, that biodiversity value will be measured by the statutory biodiversity metric. And the way that the metric works, you collect loads of data on your habitats, so your type, your condition, your area, strategic significance. You run it through the biodiversity metric and it will give you a numerical value of habitat units. And you've got to get 10% higher at the end of that.
That's really interesting. And why is it 10%? I've heard this 10% being used almost as a target, but why has that been chosen? Is 10% a reasonable request?
So it's an interesting one. So firstly, it's a minimum 10%, right? So some local planning authorities, and they can do this under the National Planning Framework, Planning Policy Framework, some local planning authorities are setting higher than 10%. So as a developer, a quick handy hint, you've always got to check your local planning authority requirement for B&G because it does vary, right? So the mandatory is a minimum 10%. And why 10%? My understanding from DEFRA is that they felt this was a reasonable contingency to get that increase in biodiversity. Biodiversity is really hard to measure. You know, as Tanish has said, it's the diversity of life. So we've got to have some proxy to measure that diversity of life. And proxies are never going to be perfect. You know, we're looking at habitat as a proxy, and I think habitats are great as a proxy of biodiversity, but a 10% gives us a bit of comfort that we are actually getting a measurable increase at the end of it.
I think it's just worth noting as well that local planning authorities, they might be putting forward that 10% biodiversity net gain, and that's something that's becoming mandatory, but local nature conservation bodies are in some areas pushing higher than that as well. So anyone working on a development project should check in perhaps on local strategies, perhaps pushed forward by the wildlife trusts and those sort of bodies, because I've seen some coming through 20% as a preference.
I think the interesting point, sorry Howard, just to jump in there, is it is the, you know, the minimum, and that's great. And the way that we need to think about it is this is the minimum because we're then building on it and on it. But the point that I want to make is we are just getting to grips with biodiversity net gain. And there's a lot of questions about the mandatory approach that still need to be answered. For anyone who has heard about it, they've probably heard of the shorthand 10% BNG, right? And I really understand that, because we've had to get biodiversity net gain on the radar. We've just had to get it in terms of the way that it's talked about. So 10% BNG has become the shorthand, and the metric has helped. You know, it helps to have a number, it helps to have that proxy indicator. But as an industry, we're now stuck. We're stuck on that conversation about 10% BNG, and I worry that we've actually lost sight on what biodiversity net gain truly is. And that's not helping. Because if you ask a project manager or an engineer, okay, you've heard about 10% BNG, what does it mean for your design? What does it mean when you're out on site? What are you actually building? And I spoke to a colleague, a project manager, about this last week in Mots, and I said, imagine that you're on site and you've got your 10%, and he knew about biodiversity net gain, right? But I asked him, what are you building? And he looked blank. And he looked blank because we've lost our way with just this generic 10% BNG. And actually what we need to talk about is the fact that biodiversity net gain is about following the mitigation hierarchy. So we're avoiding and we're reducing impacts on habitats as much as possible, particularly those high value ones, and achieving net gain by creating or enhancing habitat. And then we'll get it, right? Then we will really understand what biodiversity net gain is and how we get there. And Tanith, it's such an interesting point, isn't it? Because I do a lot of work in metrics. You obviously do a lot of work in habitats and design. So from your perspective, I know that you've kind of listened in to this talk about the metrics. So, but from your perspective, it's about habitats, isn't it?
Absolutely. So successful biodiversity net gain, it's not numbers on a spreadsheet, but it's the creation of an enhancement of wildlife rich habitats. And this requires a habitat design based on sound ecological principles. So for ecologists, you know, we've been kind of working using this approach all along, but I think we definitely need to be working a lot closer with the landscape architects to ensure that the design mindset is really focused on habitats that are going to benefit wildlife and looking beyond just sort of the metric. So it's really requires a lot of collaboration to get that biodiversity net gain design sort of sorted as early as possible.
I think that's the point, because if we've got to talk about 10% BNG, but then if we move the conversation on and talk about habitats and talk about the space that they need and talk about the fact this is wildlife rich habitats, people really understand this is about trees or scrub or grassland. And then we can start to really make sense of how this is going to work with your development. You know, where those habitats are going to go, because you can't squeeze nature into a corner and expect it to be okay. You know, you can't squeeze nature into a busy housing estate and expect it to really thrive. Or that might not be the nature that people on a housing estate really want. So to really make net gain successful in terms of both from a biodiversity point of view, but also for developers to really understand this, it's about that habitat design. And when you said that, Tanith, about collaboration, I mean, that's a bit of I think it's an interesting it's a kind of like a cultural change for us ecologists. You know, we've kind of done a lot of the protected species stuff, but now we are driving and being part of that design discussion. What's your experience of that?
Well, working on biodiversity net gain projects over the past couple of years, it's been pretty positive. But I think to ensure that collaboration is starts right from the onset of a project, we really need to make our voices heard. So from an ecological point of view, working as a consultant, it's really about getting to know your environmental manager on the project, or if there's a project manager as well. So you need to get yourself seen and heard in meetings. But I think It's also about being inquisitive and curious, asking questions about sort of other people's or disciplines' design objectives, because there are going to be constraints and there's going to be sort of clashes in sort of thoughts and what we want to achieve. So from an ecological point of view, we're going to be pushing for that 10% biodiversity net gain. And obviously with it becoming mandatory, the project should be trying to achieve that as well. But it's going to be difficult at times. So it's really about working together and trying to perhaps see where our objectives might overlap with other disciplines' objectives, and try and problem solve where things perhaps aren't going as smooth as expected. One of the important things is just making sure that we're on the same page when it comes to habitat design and creation, and that we're looking to create the same thing. So I think it's useful to mention that, Julie, sort of earlier on in whilst you were talking, you mentioned about the proxy and the biodiversity metric 4.0 user guide states that one of the principles is that biodiversity units, which are calculated as habitats, so it's good to remember that biodiversity units cover three things. So that's habitat area, hedgerows, and watercourses. And that's a proxy for biodiversity and should be treated as relative values. So how I understand this, it's about creating and enhancing the right habitats that are realistic and deliverable. And I think that's most important because we need to get it right. Otherwise, it's got the potential to fail, unfortunately. If we get it right, in turn, it's going to increase the biodiversity that those habitats will support. And it's sort of following that thought process of build it and they will come.
Build it and they will come. I know. It's the best film ever, but also it really translates well into BNG. But I think what's really important is there's a lot more emphasis coming out of, you know, the regulatory discussion about you have to evidence your metric. You know, when you run through the biodiversity metric and you see your 10%, the evidence, the justification. And so just to get consent, you know, a developer might be thinking, can I just have the metric, please? You do need a habitat design based on sound ecological principles, because that will be accompanying the metric when you submit it, you know, for planning permission. And there's really interesting discussions among local authorities and among, like Tanith, like you mentioned, like the Wildlife Trust. It's more about the evidence that the biodiversity metric is going to work and going to be feasible on site, and to have that habitat design. Otherwise, if you just turn up with a metric, I don't think, you know, it's not going to be accepted right from the start. So to have that in place. Howard, from your perspective, where do you see biodiversity net gain? Has it affected your life?
It's a great question. And at Green Blue Urban, of course, we've been involved with green infrastructure and blue infrastructure for a long time. And it's been our really at the core of our business, of making sure that we have planting that grows to maturity, that it brings us so many benefits, not just biodiversity, but what we find is that mature, healthy trees and green walls, green roofs are bringing in massive swathes of benefits that we may not even be totally aware of yet. And biodiversity is one of the most important ones of those. And we get very little biodiversity in struggling planting, for example, because there isn't the wealth or the depth of green there that's really needed to support those other life forms. I'm a bit challenged still a bit by some of the metrics. I think that the proxies, as Taylor said, they're there, but they perhaps don't give full weighting. What we find is, for example, when we're talking about tree planting, an individual tree, it may bring a lot of life in, but it doesn't seem to get the weighting that a hedgerow would have, for example. But we believe that there probably will be discussions over the next 2 to 3 years as this policy beds in, as we begin to understand what can be achieved. Personally, I believe that trees are great for biodiversity, not only because some of our native trees are amongst the most biodiverse things on our planet, but not only that, is that we can do other things underneath our biodiversity. Trees can be incorporated within our urban landscapes in a very effective way that's quite efficient on land use. So we can park a car under our biodiversity, we can walk under our biodiversity, we can sit under our biodiversity. And that, of course, is a challenge on constrained sites. How do we get enough biodiversity in when we're being pushed for more and more dense developments to make the profits we're getting, and how are we actually going to achieve this? And I think one of the questions that we're going to come up with a lot of it is, can I offsite it? You know, can we take our biodiversity and put it in an offsite position down the road? Now, personally, I have a real big problem with this personally, and I always have done, but I accept I'm a bit of a difficult on this, because I say, what's the point of putting biodiversity down the road? What we're leaving is a desert on this current site for people that are going to inhabit it. And really, if we look at this whole legislation, whether we're looking at biodiversity, whether we're looking at sustainable drainage, whether we're looking at so many benefits from green infrastructure, what we're looking at is benefits that are going to be of benefit to the people who live and work and play there. So by putting it a mile down the road, we're not going to achieve that. But what's your view on this? I mean, off-siting, I think local authorities could be quite clever and make it very expensive to off-site. But I don't know, what's your view on off-siting?
Hans, do you want to go?
Yeah, I think this actually comes up in the user guide for the biodiversity metric 4.0. So it's principal weight, and it makes a point about how proposals should aim to ensure that the habitat created is of a sufficient size for it to maintain ecological function. And then it also points to designing proposals so that they maintain habitat extent, and that's supporting more bigger, better and joined up ecological networks. So I do think you're right that, you know, we want to avoid islanding development projects and isolating people and perhaps them living in a kind of grey, slightly desert. And, you know, we've got already some of the local planning authorities have maps which show where there is lack of green space, and we should be definitely doing something about that. But also, I do think it is important from a biodiversity net gain point of view when it comes to design, is that we do have an opportunity here to not only focus on the habitats within the sites of our red line boundary that we're working on, but thinking beyond that on a landscape scale. So from my perspective, I would also be supportive of, if there's a better location to provide an offsite habitat in support of biodiversity net gain, which will actually bring about sort of a better, more joined up ecological network elsewhere in that local planning authority area, I would possibly support that as well.
That's very interesting. So we can start getting habitat connectivity for a slightly wider area, rather than necessarily just concentrating on an increase on the site, which might actually not be very balanced. So I think that's far more balanced than I am in a way of looking at it. But when we're finding that some local authorities are already asking for this ahead of it becoming mandatory, is that something you've been experiencing?
Yes, yeah, definitely. But they can do that. And I think that's one of the most important things. You know, under the National Planning Policy Framework, they can require biodiversity net gain if it's embedded in their local plan. So what we have at the moment is a bit of a scattergun approach. It's a bit of a lottery. You know, to have a minimum 10%, some outlining a minimum 30%. Some have detailed supplementary guidance on biodiversity net gain, some have specified the metric, and some aren't there yet. So one of the advantages of the mandatory approach is that it's a level playing field. It's like, okay, everyone, come on, you know, a minimum 10%, a minimum 30 years. Here's the statutory metric. Here's the statutory user guide. There's going to be an offsite register. Let's do this properly. And I think that is needed and a good place to be, but we have to recognise that that's quite a blunt framework. And for biodiversity net gain to truly make it work, to truly happen, is recognising that this is about habitats. Really, it is about habitats. And your point as well, Howard, about the on and off site debate is quite interesting, because in the good practice principles of biodiversity net gain, it makes it really simple. What's the best for biodiversity? It's not about whether it's on and off site, what's the best. Now, we do have to think about what is the best for development as well, and there's a whole host of that, and it'd be interesting actually to talk about, you know, where we are with offsetting. But it comes back to your point as well, Tanith, about we have all these different policies. Biodiversity net gain isn't a policy in isolation, but we have a driver to think what is the best for biodiversity. And there should absolutely always be greenery on your site, absolutely. But then there might be areas strategically outside your site that are going to make more sense. But I do want to touch on where we are, because I think it's important to recognise that there's no ready offset market. And there will be a time lag between mandatory biodiversity net gain coming in offset suppliers who are understandably quite hesitant at the moment because they don't know their full extent of liability. So they've got to understand that. And then they've got to get on this offsite register that Natural England have been great and given some webinars, but it's not yet published. So there's unknown about that. And it's going to be in the public domain. So what does that mean for an offset supplier? But the biggest question that if I was an offset supplier, I would have, what's the demand? So from the development side, our job is to clearly articulate our demand because we have to unlock that supply hesitancy. Carbon is so flexible. I mean, you know, you could offset your carbon credits in Indonesia. With biodiversity net gain, you can't do that. It's really local and it's really specific to habitat types. So of supply, do I plant a hedgerow? Do I plant a woodland? You know, what is the developer demand? So there's a two-way street that really we really need to get going here. We need to clearly articulate our demand in development. We absolutely need to make the most of biodiversity net gain on site, because I completely agree with you, Had, particularly in urban areas, it's really critical to build in that nature. But we need to limit that time lag between mandatory biodiversity net gain and have a brilliantly well-established offset market for the funds to be invested in grassroots fantastic conservation projects.
That's brilliant. And you've mentioned that the 30 years that this biodiversity net gain has got to be maintained. I mean, how's that going to be enforced? Is that got to be a bond up front that the developer has to pay for? Or is this something that you're going to try and chase a developer for in 25 years' time because it's failed? How does that work?
So don't hate me, but we are waiting for the government to explain all of that. What we know, which is the honest answer, I mean, we're waiting for the details of secondary legislation. What we know for the moment is it's most likely to be through a Section 106. And there are some really good examples of Section 106 wording about this. Now, and it's going to be a condition of planning. So with any planning condition, you have to discharge it, whether that's at the end of 30 years or whether it's now, is we're waiting for secondary legislation about the level of enforcement and how that would work. I think, I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether national government kind of push it down the line and say, OK, local planning authorities, you're now the ones in planning. You know, it's your planning system. Because at the moment, to discharge a planning condition does vary between different local planning authorities and it varies between the development. So they might push it down that line, but we're going to wait and see for that. Regardless of that, the most important thing is to get your planning permission. It is about justifying and evidencing your metric, which is a really, really good habitat design. And in development, playing our part to clearly articulate demand so we help encourage the offset market.
That's very, very interesting. And particularly, I can see challenges where your BNG is actually involves some of your planting or your landscape schemes within the plot of private plots. Because how can you force private house owners to maintain a certain level of biodiversity? That becomes quite a challenge. And we've got exactly the same with SUDS legislation. Can we include on plots SUDS, what we call micro SUDS, as part of a site-wide scheme? And this is quite interesting because it's throwing up quite a lot of challenges to normal legal routes. But then just perhaps going on a little bit further, the whole idea of kind of pushing this back into the market saying what it's doing, how do you think it's going to actually really make a difference? I mean, some people are saying to me, well, some sites will be undevelopable. They're just too high in biodiversity. There's no way we can achieve any more there. So therefore, those sites remain almost unavailable. I mean, do you see that same, or do you see there'll be a rush for the less biodiverse sites that already, because they're easier to add an extra 10% to? What's your thought on that, Tanith?
I think it's going to be a difficult one. I think some developers may already be considering that, to be looking for those sites which have a baseline that's already quite low with regards to biodiversity units. But in terms of thinking about it from making a difference, I think it will do in the long term. And from a design perspective, I'm already seeing that. So we're seeing that design proposals are changing. So if there's a priority habitat which scores quite highly on the metric, then previously perhaps prior to using the biodiversity net gain sort of assessment or calculation, the developer, you know, it was quite difficult for me as an ecological consultant to perhaps persuade the developer to follow the mitigation hierarchy and avoid and protect that habitat. Whereas now with the biodiversity net gain becoming mandatory and using that calculation, the fact it's quantifiable and that I can use the figures in meetings to show that there is a benefit to maintain and protect that habitat, it means that they are changing their designs quite early on. And that's from both in feasibility sort of discussions as well as early detailed design. So I think biodiversity net gain can make a difference. And we're already sort of seeing these changes and improvements to biodiversity on the projects that I'm working on.
I think that's really great. So you think we're going to see more retention of existing features, perhaps a higher value on our existing hedgerows and trees than we might have done in the past. They've been seen as almost obstacles. We try to grub them out as quick as we can. So I think that's a yeah, very positive way of looking at it.
And certainly a lot of the projects that I work on, I might work more so with engineers rather than, say, a residential development, which perhaps is slightly has different constraints. But from an engineering point of view, as long as we have these early conversations, they're great problem solvers. So if I come to them and say, we really need to maintain and protect that habitat in the interest of biodiversity net gain, and it's going to benefit the development as well when it comes to trying to compensate or offset for that habitat, they can find ways around it. But it's just having that discussion really, really early on, and certainly having a feasibility sort of calculation for biodiversity net gain up front can really help with that discussion.
I think that's very helpful. So it's going to become a point when it's just automatically part of design, where we're doing our biodiversity net gain pre-development surveys. That's just being built in, and that will probably help define how much a site is worth as to how much it's going to have to be added to that, and that's really going to give landscape value. And I think that's a great thing, that we're going to get quality landscapes that are there for the long term. One of the questions often comes up is is it the same as urban greening factor in London? And we appreciate that though they are they're different calculations, they have the same real end in view, and that's of increasing habitat, increasing our biodiversity. But how do you relate it to ecosystem services? And this is one of the buzzwords that's come out of much of our landscape discussion. How do you put the value between them, or is it hard to actually equate them because one you're looking at as a proxy for habitat, and one you're looking at the actual system value?
There's definitely a link there. So biodiversity is essential to ecosystem function and services delivery. So there are different calculations that consultants are using to assess that. If we allow the loss of biodiversity, then ecosystem services will collapse. So it's important to take both into consideration. And I benefit from working with variety of consultants at Mott MacDonald, which means that I can always go and speak to my colleagues who might be working on natural capital and ecosystem services assessments. But there are different metrics. So from an ecosystem services point of view, there is the environmental benefits from nature tool, which is designed to work alongside the biodiversity metric and provide developers, planners and other interested parties with a means of enabling wider benefits for people and nature from biodiversity net gain. So the tool uses a habitat-based approach to provide a common and consistent means of considering the direct impact of land use changes across 18 ecosystem services. So using these different metrics can be applied, but there's certainly a really important link there. And I don't think you can really necessarily assess the two separately. And I would hope that the projects that we're working on together, you can try and intertwine them at some point. And I think that's why it's important as an ecologist working on a project to understand the objectives from different environmental disciplines. So just recently I worked on a project where we produced a landscape ecology and recreational management plan. So it was looking at the habitats that we were proposing to benefit biodiversity, but how they were also supporting landscape and recreational uses as well.
I think that's very helpful. So do you see, as we move forward, we'll see a far more collaborative approach within the design process? We'll see more people around the table early doors seeking to try and understand what each discipline is trying to achieve, and then seeing how that can work in a collaborative way so that we're all achieving our ends rather than doing it in a siloed sort of fashion.
Absolutely. I think if a design progresses without these people in place, then it's likely to result in potential delays. The biodiversity net gain calculation might be more difficult to undertake. It might be more difficult to achieve that 10% biodiversity net gain. So getting people in at the right time, especially sort of an understanding on the different design freezes in a project and program is especially important, and sharing that with the different teams. But for landscape and landscape architects and ecologists, them two sort of working together as a partnership is really important going forward too, for the biodiversity net gain assessments.
I think that's really great, because too often we've seen landscape even being relegated to reserve matters long after the project's underway, which has then been very difficult to start retrofitting proper biodiversity in when you've got fragmented little spaces. That's all that's left over once everything else has been done, what's being called slope, space left over after planning. And I thought, well, that's really, we've got to start thinking about it a different way. And I think you mentioned this before, Julia, when we talk about biodiversity net gain, is really a team sport. We've got to work together across disciplinary to make this really, really get what we're looking for. And the last question I'd like to have now really is, how's the audit process going to work? How's that actually going to, are we going to have sufficient inspectors that are available to look at this? How is this going to be maintained legally? And is there going to be a long-term liability that really exists for the next 30 years on these sites we're looking at now?
Yeah, and just to, sorry, double back, I can't let this conversation go without saying my favourite part of BNG is the fact that it's a team sport. I mean, it really is great, and it does require everyone to have a seat at the table. And there's a really interesting play there, because you've got to have the strength of voice to be able to have that seat at the table and have that discussion. But it is a team sport. And just to echo, Tanith, what you said, some people think about it as a problem, but the winners think about it as a puzzle to solve. And it's such a tiny little change in language, but when you look at it as a puzzle, that everyone has a piece to say, actually, we can solve this puzzle, it just makes all the difference in the world. So yeah, I think, Howard, you're absolutely right. How is this going to work? Who's going to be enforcing it? How many, do we have any inspectors? We know that local planning authorities don't have enough ecologists. How is it going to work? And we are still waiting. We're still waiting. Yeah. And we've got months until it. I mean, even if it's the end of November, but that isn't stopping us building in good practice. Biodiversity net gain good practice principles were published in 2016. They're still relevant. We have the British standard on biodiversity net gain. That's still relevant. So there is obviously what is going to happen under mandatory net gain. But what we are doing is building in good practice. Good practice is to have a metric calculation at the end of construction. Things change during construction. I've worked far too long construction sites to know that things do change. And so you have to reset. And that now might have implications for your planning conditions. So we've got to get prepared for that. We're then building in regular management and monitoring, because over 30 years, things will change. We're going to get extreme weather events. We have to keep it on track. So I completely echo the can someone please tell us, how is this going to work? Unfortunately, we're going to wait for that, but it doesn't stop us designing in all the nuts and bolts that I need to give my client the assurance that they will get their planning permission and BNG will actually work on the ground.
I think that's
it. Sorry, Howard. I was just going to say it might be worth mentioning that although I feel like we're still sort of far off from hearing a bit more about how it will be audited, but these are conversations on how it might look when it comes to perhaps reporting on that in terms of what that might look like. The Chartered Institute of Ecology and Environmental Management have produced a set of templates with some headings, and one of them does include a biodiversity net gain audit report template. So for practitioners who might need to produce a report for a condition as planning consent, there is a template that's been published by CIME. So that's quite useful to have a look at, and certainly from an ecology and landscape architect point of view, I think there's going to be or need to be more of a crossover when it comes to the production of landscape and ecology management plans to work out how biodiversity net gain assessments and habitat management and monitoring will be tied in, so that we're going to be having to work together to produce these documents that are going to be satisfy and discharge planning conditions as well.
I think that's great, because one of the challenges we have, as you know, with the urban trees is that too often it's the maintenance or lack of it that really causes the failure of the design. Design's good, some of the implementation not been too bad, but then if it's not maintained, the whole thing then just falls through the floor. And I think when we're looking at 30 years, that's a significant amount of time. What we find is that most of the trees that have failures usually fail between 5 and 7 years. So just out of the 5-year dead and disease planning condition. But, you know, people say, oh, trees die. And we say, well, it doesn't need to. You know, we need to have maintenance protocols in there to make sure that we get that 30 years we're looking for, so that we can really hand on resilient, sustainable landscapes that are bringing us that a biodiversity that we need. And we've got this climate change coming. We may find that our biodiversity changes. We're already seeing some changes in our species that are because of our temperature changes. We are finding that different plant species are becoming more more relevant with our changes in temperature. So I think we're living in a very, very interesting time within the landscape and within construction, because we're looking at reducing our carbon footprints, we're looking at sequestering as much carbon as we can, but we're really looking at providing healthy habitats for biodiversity, but also for ourselves, because I love that quote that as we look after nature, we look after ourselves. So
a lot of people are concerned about the Natural England Offsite Register, but I think with auditing, it's not for auditing purposes, right? What we don't know everything about the Offsite Register, but what we do know, it is to show allocation. So it's not a matchmaking service. It's not here, you know, matchmaking developers with offset suppliers, but it's to show allocations. And so there will be some level of enforcement, but also I think it will help that conversation, because it should show the allocations and it should show where should biodiversity net gain be. Now, there has been discussion about whether that should have been on or offsite as well as, you know, it's just offsite. For those interested in on-site BNG, that information is available public through the planning portal. So it's a little bit clunky, but I think there'll be this. Whenever I talk about biodiversity net gain, there's so much care to make it work. You know, that people are so invested in it. It's such a topic in terms of let's really do something here. And I think, yes, we're still waiting for the secondary legislation, but it will also come down to us to really build in what we need to do in terms of making that work over 30 years.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate it, Julia. Really appreciate your time, Dennis, as well. Thank you very much indeed from all of us at Green Blue Urban. I think you've really opened my eyes, and I think that we can see there's some great opportunities that we have the it's actually within our grasp to make changes so that we can reverse some of these deficiencies that we are seeing, particularly in our urban areas, and that we can see a better, healthier place for everyone. Thank you very much.
Many thanks.